Hey everyone, welcome back to the Conscious Resistance Network. My name is Derek Bros, and I have another important interview today with a returning guest, friend, colleague, and all-around amazing journalist, Whitney Webb. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for making some time. I've seen you're already back to your busy schedule promoting the books that we're going to be talking about. And I said books, not book, books. So we'll talk about that and more. But how's it been? I mean, let's just kind of pull you back out from under the rock you've been under writing for the last year plus. Like, how are you feeling?
I'm pretty tired, but happy to be done. So I'm sure a lot of people knew that this book took a long time. Part of that is because I agreed to do it in January 2020. And obviously 2 months later, things got really crazy. So, and we're still living through that craziness, at least in to various degrees, depending where you are in the world. So, you know, it was interesting to try and balance my desire to write about what was currently happening with writing what is fundamentally like a history book, right? Because towards the end of the book, it gets into, you know, some more modern stuff, Silicon Valley, and some more recent work that I've done, but it's mostly historical, right? So, and it starts as far back as the 1920s. So, you know, it's definitely like a history thing. And it was kind of hard to balance that with, you know, the Great Reset and the COVID stuff and all, you know, so much going on. It was like, oh my gosh, I need like three of me to do what I want in terms of the content I want to get out. But I didn't want to delay the book anymore because I think the history is actually really important. I think we've gotten to a point where a lot of people have been really well informed about, you know, why COVID happened the way it played out, the way it did, what the Great Reset is, what its ambitions are in the short, medium, and in long terms. And I think what my book will help people realize is, you know, sort of maps out a lot of the power structure as it exists in the United States, but also in some other countries of the world. I don't know if it's necessarily a portrayal of the entire global elite, and I don't claim that. But I think it's definitely a detailed look at one particular faction, how they came to be and how they've developed over the years and the various scandals and illegal activity and various rackets they've been involved with over the years, including, you know, sex trafficking and sex blackmail. And it basically traces the fusion of organized crime with intelligence in the US and how that sort of that same model, you know, touches places like Israel, the UK, and even China, which are basically the four countries that come up over and over again in the book.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I can say I definitely understand that struggle between like writing about the current thing going on, like at the time, the Great Reset, COVID, 1984, all that important stuff. And also at the same time, like you said, kind of trying to take a step back and say, hey, this is an important piece of history that needs to be documented. And so I can empathize with that for sure. Well, let's talk about the books. And I want to get into some of the details. Obviously, we're going to encourage everybody to pick up a copy of the books. And again, books. So go ahead and explain that to us, because originally everybody thought there's going to be one book. It's titled
so
One Nation Under Blackmail. And so did you. So what ended up happening here?
Okay. So yeah, it was supposed to be one book. And it's so people understand, I've never written a book before. This is my first attempt at a book. And, you know, in word processor, it's a certain length. And then when you actually go about to typesetting it for a book, that changes the length from what you thought it was. So anyway, as a book, it ended up being like 900 pages. And so with all the other stuff that has to be included with books and with citations, because this is very heavily sourced. For all the people that want to call me a crazy conspiracy theorist, all primary sources in my end notes are mainstream media. So please try and debunk me. Anyway, that ended up making it too long. So as far as a physical copy goes, the publisher insisted on it being volumes 1 and volume 2. For people that are familiar with my original Mint Press series on Epstein in 2019, it was four parts, and the first two were about sort of the network behind Epstein, and parts 3 and 4 were about Epstein and the Maxwells. So basically, volume 1 is the buildup of that network, and includes a lot on Robert Maxwell himself. towards the end anyway. And then part two is the one that's focused almost entirely on Epstein and the Maxwell family for people that are interested in that. But, you know, if you're just going to buy volume two because you want the Epstein stuff, I can understand that. But there's a lot of references to stuff that take place in volume one. And one of the reasons why something like what is the content that's in volume one is important is because, you know, for example, when I was doing interviews in 2019 and 2020 about Epstein, people, you know, I would say stuff like, you know, Epstein had ties to the Iran-Contra situation, or, you know, one of his clients in the early 80s was Adnan Khashoggi. And if you don't know who like Adnan Khashoggi was or what Iran-Contra really was, you know, it's hard to really understand the significance of that. Or if I'm like, based on the evidence we have, it looks like Epstein was involved with the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or BCCI, during the 1980s. You know, if you don't know what BCCI was or how it interfaced with things like the Promise Software scandal and Iran-Contra and those things, you know, you're not really going to understand the significance of that as it relates to Epstein's intelligence connections, right? So that's what volume one, like, fleshes out in detail, as well as how organized crime and intelligence got in bed with each other, when it happened, and how it ended up developing to the point where you can't tell where one ends and the other begins anymore. And it's been like that since like the 70s and 80s, where you can't really distinguish between them anymore. And, you know, there's a lot of really significant things that happened in that period. So if you want that background, I would encourage you to get volume one. If you think you know everything about, you know, those players and those events, then I guess get volume two. But I tried to make it so there's a lot of detail in volume one for even people that feel like they're informed about those events.
And I do see that here it says on the Trine Day website, there will be a bundle available to get both books for $34.95. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's correct. So that's the cheapest way to get both physical copies. And right now, I think that's only available in the continental U.S. or places where shipping from the continental U.S. isn't that expensive. For people in Europe, we're talking to some distributors to get the bundle available there. For people that don't like that price period, there's going to be an ebook and an audiobook, and that's going to be volumes one and two together. So the whole book together is one thing, an ebook and audiobook, and that's definitely going to be the most cost effective way to get this material. I'm not in this to make money. I just want people to read the book and have a, you know, have a discussion about, you know, its contents.
No, but it's definitely, I will be buying a copy, and I definitely recommend everybody pick up a copy, whether it's the physical copy, the audiobook, the ebook, because, you know, I have written a few books before, and I know the amount of time it takes to do this, and especially when you're putting together a work like yours. I mean, everybody knows the extent of your research and how much time and energy you put into it. And also, I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, in this time period, you've become a mother again, and you've tried to keep up with Unlimited Hangout and Last American Vagabond and everything else. So it's nice to get paid a little bit for, you know, to have a meal after working so hard. but yeah, let's go ahead if you can. Let's dive in a little bit deeper into the organized crime aspect. This is something that I think is often overlooked, and I think it's probably one of the most crucial points, because I've been doing a lot of research separately from Epstein on the organized crime, the mafia, particularly where I'm originally from in Houston, the Galveston Mafia, Tillman Fertitta, Las Vegas. A lot of these people are really still around. Most people don't realize that the mafia, we kind of think of it as this thing from like back in the roaring 20s, you know, machine guns and like
that's intentional. All.
Yeah, and like, you know, the Goodfellas, those are old days. The mafia doesn't have any more power anymore, right? But clearly what you're showing, and anybody who's looked at Epstein and looked at people like Les Wexner and the mafia back in Ohio, they're very powerful. So could, you know, without giving away the book, could you share a little bit of what you found?
Yeah, totally. So organized crime never went away. And I think what you mentioned about this idea through Hollywood, which is still owned by the mob, you could say in some key ways, is to sort of portray it as like, you know, glamorize it and treat it as something that, you know, disappeared in the 40s and 50s. And that's totally inaccurate. Basically, what happened is that they got in bed with intelligence. They got state protection for their activities. And they took over corporate America. I mean, that's like the short version of it. And when you look back at trials, for example, I don't know, like the Pizza Connection trials and stuff in the 1980s, where they took down, you know, Tony Salerno and people like that, that was consolidation of mob territory. And there's a long history of this happening. It makes the careers of prosecutors who go on to be politicians, who are then tough on crime, but very much in bed with the so-called deep state. So with the pizza connection stuff, that was Rudy Giuliani prosecuting. And, you know, turn look at what kind of politician he turned out to be. He has no qualms working with obvious criminals. So, one example of this would be earlier in history would be when they took down this mobster guy, Lepke Buckle. I forget exactly how you say his name because I'm not very good at pronouncing. I've never heard it before. I've just read it. But Thomas Dewey and a guy named William O'Dwyer were the prosecutors for that guy. And he was a mobster and he was taken down, but he was taken down with the cooperation of his supposed friends in organized crime, like Mayor Lansky, Lucky Luciano, and all those guys basically backstabbed him and turned him over to the feds because they wanted to consolidate. Right. And Luciano and Lansky are the people that were key figures in what is called Operation Underworld, which was when the Office of Naval Intelligence made a formal alliance with organized crime to gather intelligence out of wartime necessity. And of course, you know, after the war, they justified its continuation. And you happened that same thing. It wasn't just the Office of Naval Intelligence. The precursor to the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services, was also involved. But anyway, going back to those trials, those prosecutors, Thomas Dewey became governor of New York. He almost became president of the United States. William O'Dwyer went on to be mayor of New York and ended up having to flee the country because he was so obviously in bed with the same organized crime interests that he was supposedly prosecuting, right? So a lot of time it's sort of, you know, you have these things like it's a public show of, look, the justice system works and we're taking down organized crime, but they don't take down the big kingpins ever. And they never have. It's all about consolidation for those people. And they eventually end up, you know, dominating more and more and more over time. And as I know in the book, one of these organized crime kingpins basically is a close business associate of Leslie Wexner. And it seems like Leslie Wexner himself really is one. Edward De Bartolo, who's a major, was a major real estate baron involved with like shopping malls and all of this stuff, had like insane organized crime ties when it comes specifically to the people around Mayor Lansky and people like that in terms of like financial flows, and had a lot of involvement with like money laundering, scams on banks, fraud, all sorts of stuff, and was a business associate of Wexner's through the 1980s. And another guy really involved with the world of shopping malls in the U.S., Adolf Alfred Taubman, was a mentor to Leslie Wexner, father and son relationship, according to Wexner, and was also tied to organized crime, linked businessmen and these exact same networks through various real estate deals and other deals. So it's pretty crazy in writing this history because, you know, it basically the people that got rich from retail, whether it's, you know, making suburban shopping malls, like the physical space of the mall, or the stores within the mall, like Leslie Wexner's retail empire, Victoria's Secret, Bath and Body Works, the Limited 2, you know, all of that stuff. You know, these are guys that are basically, you know, the modern day mob in a sense. And it's not just for retail, obviously. I mean, it's pretty much every major industry is under the thumb of people like this. And a lot of them boast intelligence ties or are very close and cozy with the national security state apparatus of either the U.S. or in Wexner's case, also the state of Israel. And what's interesting also, I point out why that is, or try to, in the book, because a lot of the organized crime networks that came to prominence in the 1940s were intimately involved with the arming of the precursor of the Israeli military, the Haganah, but people like Bugsy Siegel, who made like, you know, sort of founded Las Vegas for an organized crime and stuff, you know, was very involved in basically arming, you know, Zionist paramilitary groups that later went on to create the State of Israel. And so when Israel is established, those networks remain there and they continue to, you know, have associations with the IDF and in later Mossad when that's founded. And, you know, those associations have continued with, you know, with the State of Israel. It's been there since the beginning because Israel's not that old of a country. all things considered. But in the U.S., I mean, these people have taken control for a long time. And one of the ways organized crime was able to get in this way and dominate so much is because they took over the unions in New York, at least, and by the 20s. And that allowed them to basically control the Democratic Party in New York. And this happened on a major scale throughout the country. And they blackmailed J. Edgar Hoover, which is something I wrote about in my original series in Mint Press News, is that they sexually blackmailed J. Edgar Hoover because he was a gay man at a time when it was not okay to be gay. And they basically held that over his head. And, you know, Hoover also had an obsession with blackmail. So he, you know, later himself got involved in the same blackmail racket and used it to accumulate blackmail on other people for his own you know, ambitions of power and control and whatever. But there's a reason the FBI never went after organized crime while he was director of the FBI, and he was director of the FBI for a very long time. So the subversion of FBI as an institution goes back like almost 100 years, basically. The vast majority of its existence as an institution for people that are, I don't know, looking at the Mar-a-Lago raid and being like, oh, the FBI is corrupt. The FBI has been corrupt. Sorry to tell you. And they've been corrupted by like organized crime. They're the highest law enforcement body in the nation.
So if we could, let's go a little bit deeper into this. I'm curious if, you know, for one, what you just talked about, the beginning of the Haganah in Israel, I find that really interesting because I just spent, you know, probably a month or more just deep into that history for an upcoming episode of the Pyramid of Power series on the intelligence networks, not just the US, but British, Israeli, Chinese, and Russian. I kind of focused on them. And I saw a lot about what you're describing there, like the beginnings of the Haganah, like kind of militia forces, which eventually lead to, you know, the actual establishment of the IDF. So it's really interesting to hear the connections there. But could you talk a little bit more? Or did your research go into, I mean, I know you've touched on this prior to this, but in the book, do you elaborate any further on intelligence connections between Wexner and the Mega Group itself? And for those who are unfamiliar, the Mega Group being the, you know, in their own words, the Jewish group, the group of powerful Jewish philanthropists coming together to, you know, focus on Jewish interests. And I know that there is some connections through Wexner, through Cleveland and Ohio and that mafia there. But is the Mega Group itself, would you consider that to be part of that mafia apparatus as well?
So, you know, the problem with reporting on the Mega Group is that there's like only one report on them that's ever really come out. And it was published like maybe 7 years after they were founded. It was made in 1991 by Leslie Wexner and Charles Bronfman. And it listed in there several of their most prominent members, but not all their members. And, you know, there's no subsequently updated membership list for like now or anytime since then. So you basically have to go off a very limited amount of material. But within that list, relatively small list of the people they list, there's a lot of people tied to organized crime beyond Leslie Wexner. The Bronfmans, you have Charles and Edgar Bronfman. There's ties to organized crime I detail to an extent in my original Mint Press News series. I detail it extensively in the book. The Bronfmans, Seagrams, their rise to prominence intimately linked to organized crime because it had to do with the prohibition stuff and bootlegging and all of that. And those associations didn't really change. They did become more private because Sam Bronfman, the patriarch of the Bronfman family, was like very obsessed with status and didn't want to be marred by that. But I mean, as late as, you know, congressional Senate hearings in the 1950s, basically aired it out to a significant degree, the ongoing Bronfman organized crime association. And, you know, in the book, again, I detail how it continued with, you know, his most prominent children, you know, Charles and Edgar. Beyond that, you have people like Michael Steinhardt, whose father was Mayor Lansky's jewel fence. I mean, it's like very obvious, the organized crime tie there. And Steinhardt's father was his initial career initial funder of his Wall Street career very early on in Michael Steinhardt's Wall Street career. He's intimately involved with a guy named Mark Rich, who's a very controversial commodities trader with a very obvious and documented tie to Israeli intelligence, Mossad specifically, and to BCCI, for example. Which is a bank that I talk a lot about in the book and is very linked to intelligence and organized crime networks. Michael Steinhardt also employed a guy that was teamed up with Robert Booth Nichols, who's this organized crime guy who figures very prominently in the Promise software scandal and also in the death of the journalist Danny Casolaro in 1991. And like throughout his history has maintained associations like that. Another guy that's interesting that's also listed on the mega group is Lester Crown, the son of Henry Crown. And if you're familiar with Gus Russo and his book Super Mob, which is, you know, sort of about these same organized crime networks with a focus in Chicago and also California on sort of the, you know, the intersections between government, corporate America, and organized crime. Henry Crown features very prominently in that book as a key player in what Gus Russo terms the super mob. And Lester Crown is his son and maintained a lot of those same associations. And there's a few other ones, too, that I note in the book, but off the top of my head, I sort of forgetting. Steven Spielberg, who's the protege of Lou Wasserman, who's probably like the most notorious like corporate executive of his era with just extreme obvious organized crime ties just all over him, which actually go back to Ohio. He's originally from Ohio and then took over MCA. Which is Music Corporation of America, now Universal Studios. And after, you know, Wasserman, his era sunsetted it, that studio was passed off to the Bronfmans. So, you know, they keep it pretty cozy. But so 1991 is when the mega group gets founded by these guys with these particular associations. And it's basically the goal is, I guess what I would call ethno-philanthropy, you know, philanthropy targeted on a specific, you know, ethno-religious group, in this case, the Jewish community. And what it's mainly focused on is basically permeating the North American Jewish community with certain views, as it relates to the state of Israel, most of which are basically political at the end of the day. And you can see that through Michael Steinhardt, for example. Michael Steinhardt has been on the record that he's an atheist and thinks that all Jewish people should replace Judaism with Zionism, which is, you know, Jewish nationalism, you know. So basically replace your religion and religious identity with nationalism. And that's more or less the types of views that a lot of these mega group billionaires seem to have. And they're behind really well-known groups like Birthright, which takes like teenage North American, you know, Jewish teenagers to Israel. So, but, you know, it's been criticized a lot for giving them only a very one-sided view of Israel and not going to the Palestinian territories and, you know, basically sort of imbuing them with a very specific perspective about the state of Israel and various other, you know, related issues. The other thing, though, is that the mega groups, I wrote about this in my original series. It seems like they had some sort of intersection with this mega spy scandal in the late 1990s, because a lot of, and that was related to some intercepted Mossad call talking about mega, and people thought mega was a particular, you know, a particular person, sort of like a Jonathan Pollard figure that was buried deep into the, I guess the national security apparatus. I can't remember exactly what place they thought this person was targeting. I think it was a diplomatic document. They wanted to get it from Mega, this intercepted call between Mossad people. But actually, some of the figures at the Mega group, like Max Fisher, who's another mentor to Wexner, had access to diplomatic documents all the time. He was like a private diplomat and go-between the U.S. and Israel. So it really wouldn't have been that weird for them to use it. And a lot of these billionaires, especially Wexner, have a lot of very close ties to Israel's government. Actually, some of the most prominent people in Israel's government since the late 1980s have been Wexner Israel fellows, including people at the highest levels of the IDF, the highest levels of Israel's government, Israeli Supreme Court justices, all financed at one point or another by Wexner. And same with the governing bodies of AIPAC and the most powerful arms of, you know, the Israel lobby in the U.S., dominated by Wexner. And this is really significant. I've already put out this part of the this part of the book online on my website about how Wexner basically, when it comes to him talking about his own spiritual life, basically says that he's possessed by what in the Jewish faith is often translated from Yiddish into English as demon. And if you look into the definitions, you know, of that particular term, you know, in various Jewish encyclopedias and you know, other sources of reference, it's never used in a positive sense. And it's basically akin to like a, it's basically defined as a spirit that cannot move on to the afterlife because it's committed so many awful sins and clings to an existing person. And Wexner, in a 1985 article, describes this entity stuck to him as an integral part of his genius. It's a demon he really loves. That's a direct quote, that looks just like him. And he has a stunted, his stunted self that he calls the treasured son part, like son of his, you know, parents, like the little boy is stunted inside of him and dominated by this other entity that makes him gobble up more and more corporations and different things and grow his empire to be more and more powerful. Does that sound like someone you want to dominate the North American Jewish community and have a major impact on Jewish life? Someone who says they're literally, I mean, can you imagine that in the Christian context? Someone says they're possessed by Satan, but they're running all these like Christian youth groups and dominating like the leadership of the Catholic Church and like all this. I mean, that would be like nuts, right? But in this
case, yeah. I just want to cut in there, Whitney. I mean, for one, I think that's I'm glad that you've dug in and found that much about Wexner and his personal views, because I do think that in this case, like understanding him as a person, since we don't have a whole lot of, you know, information beyond some of his relationships, and we have very limited information, as you said, on the mega group, that, you know, we have to infer some information based on who these people are with their actions, their words, you know, the kind of things that they say. So that's important there. And I also want to just commend you for continuing to keep the story of Danny Casolaro alive. I have the book right here with me, The Last Circle, Danny Casolaro's Investigation into the Octopus and Promise Software Scandal, written by Chris Seymour from Trine Day as well. And you know, these are stories that not only just like, hey, here's a journalist who is digging into a lot of the stuff that you know, people like us are trying to pick up the pieces of 20 something years later, 30 years later, but it was another journalist that was killed in the line of duty, you know, in the line of work. You know, I don't think anybody really believes Danny Casolaro killed himself based on the evidence. And as you said, there are some people who maybe are only going to want to get book two of yours and just focus on like the current Epstein network. But I do think that it's important to understand these roots, you know, and I kind of run into this sometimes with some of the investigations I'm on. People will say, well, what does that matter? That was 30 years ago, right? Or who are those people? They're all dead. You know, who cares, right? Yeah. But not only does it matter, I think, in the sense of like just true accountability, that the truth needs to come to light, you know, regardless of how much time has passed. But also, once you dig into these kind of stories, you start to realize that not all the people are dead. Some of the people who have allowed these things to happen or have played roles are still in positions of power and have moved on to other places. So it's not like this is just some fun story to talk about. It's like, this is consequential to what we're living right now.
Or they're advising, you know, anti-establishment presidential candidates, right? Some of the people, like the Promise Software scandal, which is what Danny Casolaro was investigating at the time he was killed. A major player in that is Ed Meese, who is still alive and was attorney general under Reagan. And he's been a major advisor to Donald Trump. So, you know, that's another thing about Trump. You know, he's one of the guys that's like been in these networks for a long time. Yeah, he may have like, you know, ended his relationship, friendship, whatever, with Epstein in the early 2000s. But I would argue that he was always closer to the Maxwell side of things. Pictures of him on Robert Maxwell's Lady Ghislaine yacht, pictures of him hanging around, not just Jeffrey Epstein in the early 90s, but also Ghislaine Maxwell. The accusations about Donald Trump's Russian mob ties are actually more like Maxwell family, crime family ties, because Robert Maxwell, his main business partners, by the time he died, were, you know, big time Russian mobsters like Semyon Mogilevich and people like that. And it tends to be, you know, those types of figures that crop up and wherever there's allegations of Russian mob ties to Donald Trump's real estate. empire, and that's just because New York real estate is what it is, right? It's never really been a clean business.
Can I just ask you one question, Whitney, real quick? So since you mentioned it, because I'm curious if you've dug in further or what you've found. But so, okay, obviously you just mentioned Trump, so a bunch of people's heads exploded, and they're now ready to turn this off. You're clearly a shill, and you know, okay, all those kinds of things. But for people like yourself and myself and others who've actually dug into the relationship between Trump and Epstein, you know, one of the claims, even just in the past 24 hours, that I often hear whenever this conversation comes up is that, no, Trump kicked Epstein out of Mar-a-Lago. And in fact, often my own interview with Bradley Edwards, who is the attorney, as you know, who is defending a lot of the Epstein victims, my own interview that I did at Epstein's, one of the trials back in 20, I can't remember, but a few years ago, I interviewed him and I asked him directly, I said, can you tell me, you know, is there any truth to these claims that Trump kicked Epstein out of Mar-a-Lago? And even Brad Edwards, who's been working on that case for 20 years now, said he'd heard that, of course, but he couldn't verify that. He looked into it and couldn't find any actual records. So I started digging into it. Like, where is the source of this besides Trump claiming after the fact, after Epstein had been exposed, that he had severed the relationship? And I looked into it, and you know the guy, James Patterson, the fiction author who's also wrote a book with Bill Clinton? Yeah, yes. Of course. So for those who don't know, James Patterson, fiction author in the United States, but he also is good buddies and lived in the same area as Epstein and Trump. And he's wrote this book and did a tour with Bill Clinton. He's got some really interesting connections, but it's his book, Filthy Rich, that seems to be the sort of source for this story that of the claim that Epstein had kicked or that Trump had kicked Epstein out. But because of James Patterson's connections to Bill Clinton and other folks, I tend to think that that story is sketchy at best. And, you know, I just don't, like, in my mind, because there's no hard evidence other than, like, you know, people want to say, no, Trump kicked him out. You know, there could be some records of it, but nobody that I've seen has actually been able to confirm that. And James Patterson's source is some member of the club that he talked to or something like that. But yeah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Do you think that that's like still a legitimate piece of history, people should pull that out? Or do you think that was, in my mind, it was maybe created out of cloth after Epstein was arrested to give Trump some cover?
Yeah, I it's not verifiable. And the evidence that does exist about the ending of their relationship suggests that it was about a quabble over purchasing a piece of Palm Beach real estate, which, honestly, both of these guys, including Epstein, very involved in real estate markets. I would argue that Epstein's interest in real estate markets was intimately related to his role in money laundering for these same organized crime and intelligence networks and a lot of his financial crimes that he committed throughout his career, which are not a focus of the investigations into him and the case. I would argue that his financial crimes are just as significant, if not more significant, than his sex crimes. So with allegations of suspect financial activity by, you know, Trump's real estate interests and then Epstein's own history, they're competing for this Palm Beach property. That's apparently when their relationship soured because it was a rather acrimonious competition for that particular property. But, you know, if it was really something as simple as you were doing shady stuff and I threw you out of Mar-a-Lago, I think Trump would have been willing to say that on record, and he hasn't. He has declined to say what the exact reason for their split was. He won't say it.
Exactly. So
that should tell you, that should tell people a lot. If it was really something that paints him in a positive light as kicking Epstein out of Mar-a-Lago or something like that, he would be touting that. And he did not. At the same time, what I said earlier about the Maxwell stuff, Trump likely being closer to the Maxwell interest. Just look at how Trump reacted to the arrest of Jeffrey Epstein in 2019 and his reaction to Ghislaine Maxwell's arrest roughly a year later. You have him being asked about Epstein. I don't like him. We haven't talked in a long time. Nothing to do with him, blah, blah, blah. Maxwell, I wish her well.
Yeah. And I want to add to that as well, because what I mentioned there about my interview with Brad Edwards, I actually got contacted by Fox News asking if they could use this interview because they wanted to use it to trump it up. Like, see, look, the lawyer says Trump, blah, blah. Because what Brad Edwards told me, he said, well, I can't confirm that story about Trump kicking Epstein out of Mar-a-Lago. And this is what he said. He said, but what I can tell you is that when I sent out subpoenas and I started contacting people, Donald Trump was the only person that responded, that offered help. It was cooperative, right? Yeah. So people take that interview I did and they try to spin it like, see, see. But I mean, in my mind, again, if you were friends or associated with somebody like Maxwell and Epstein, as he was, for 20 years or so, and then you realize they're going down, yeah, you're probably going to start selling them out or offering some, hey, I got some information for you.
Yeah,
it doesn't really show me that Trump has a strong character or anything.
I think, if the real estate thing is what really happened and it was about that particular property and you have a guy that's like, you know, trying to screw you over financially and you want to get back at him and that's sort of how the relationship ends up ending, then yeah, you would probably cooperate in a legal probe against him. If you feel like he really screwed you. And there's a history of people associated with Epstein financially who feel like he really screwed them over. Yep. You know, and Trump wouldn't be alone in that. That's for sure.
I appreciate you taking the time with us today. I think we've covered a good amount of information and hopefully teased enough that people need to get a copies of this two-volume book now that you've put so much time and energy into. But I guess my final question is, just to sum things up, why does it matter that Jeffrey Epstein had connections to intelligence and mafia? Why does that matter today in 2022 and going forward?
Okay. Jeffrey Epstein's intelligence connections and organized crime connections are really significant for a number of reasons, but I guess the most important one is that this is the network that enabled him to do what he did for so long, and it existed well before Epstein engaged in those activities, and now that he is gone, it continues to exist. And we cannot change anything or prevent such crimes from happening again unless we interrogate those power structures that enabled him to operate in the way he did and commit really horrific crimes with near complete impunity. Keep in mind that people like Cindy McCain in early 2020, the wife of deceased Senator John McCain, said, "We all knew what Epstein was doing." And, you know, that should be pretty telling to people that it was well known in elite circles in DC, New York, what was going on. Nothing was done. That speaks, you know, to the power that someone like Epstein wielded, but it wasn't exclusively his power. It was the power of network that benefited from his activities. And that network continues to exist.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Whitney, for sharing this information with us. I do hope that everybody will pick up a copy of these books, and whether the audiobook, ebook, physical copies, wherever you're at. Because as you just said, Whitney, I mean, learning this history, which is, in the grand scheme of things, it's recent history. You know, maybe people are like, oh, 60 years ago, 70 years, 100 years ago, what do I care what was going on back then? You know, what the mafia was up to back then. But the truth is that the seeds that were planted of corruption, of crime, of blackmail, of sex trafficking, of sexual abuse of young children, young girls, those seeds were planted in the past, and they will continue to, you know, to develop and grow. And as you were just saying, they will continue into the future if we don't, if we don't interrogate the past and ask how this happened. And unfortunately, with Epstein, the public has been taught this idea that it all got taken care of. Epstein went to prison, yeah.
And he was an anomaly.
Yeah, it was just this
brand anomaly.
Mm-hmm. And Maxwell, she's locked up now. She's going to go to Camp Fed. You know, everything's good. It was all put into a nice bow. But as you said, when you look at pieces of the puzzle, you hear statements from Cindy McCain and others. It's clear that way more people knew this was going on. And those people would like for us to just close the book on this, move on with our lives, and just mm-hmm. laugh and hashtag Epstein didn't kill himself. But the reality yeah. is that this darkness is still with us. The people who allowed it to happen and who perpetuate these networks are still alive and in power in different places. And even the ones who have passed on, I think that their reputations deserve to be tarnished with the truth. I mean, honestly, I think that that's so. I appreciate your time. Whitney, anything else you want to leave us with today before we get out of here?
Yeah, it just sort of touched on something you just brought up, that there's been this effort to paint Jeffrey Epstein as an anomaly. I would argue what you just pointed out is the actual reason why Ghislaine Maxwell was even arrested in the first place. And that case was carefully constructed to only put her away for a certain amount of time. And now she's been moved to a low security country club prison and stuff. I mean, that was pretty predictable, in my opinion. But I think it was because, you know, people were outraged still, even after, you know, the thing with Epstein. That wasn't enough for people. And they're going to hope that now they can finally memory hole the case and convince people to trust their institutions, right? Because that's been the main push from groups like the World Economic Forum and all these other entities tied into these power structures, is rebuilding trust, getting people to trust institutions again, even though they continue to be so fundamentally corrupted as they have been for decades and decades, as I endeavor to show in the book. So, you know, we have to keep the outrage up. It shouldn't stop just because Ghislaine Maxwell's in country club prison. Okay. We have to keep the heat on. And we can't let the case die. And that's for, you know, a number of reasons. I hope my book will bring up a lot of stuff on Epstein's career that haven't been touched on at all, because there is a lot of scandals to come out, I think, that go beyond the sex trafficking, particularly as it relates to Epstein's relationship with the Clinton White House in the 90s. There's a reason they Mark Middleton was offed in May, the guy that Epstein was meeting at the Clinton White House. He was definitely offed in May for a reason. And it's because, in my opinion, the Epstein's visitor logs were made public just a couple months before he was found hanging from a tree with an extension cord around his neck and a shotgun blast to the chest. There's something really crazy going on there. And just to give you a hint, the first time George W. Bush invoked executive privilege as president was to block documents about Mark Middleton going to congressional investigators, Bush, Clinton's successor.
Wow. That's so they cover insane. Up for each other. Oh. Yeah, they keep covering up for each other, whether left or right, right? I think that's the big thing that people need to take away, hopefully even the Trump supporters. And I think that your book is probably going to do a great job to show that we truly are one nation, if not one world, under blackmail. And I really look forward to checking it out, Whitney, and then doing future interviews and future investigations on the work that you've found and see where it goes. So thank you so much for your time. Everybody, go check out the book. I'll put links to it. Of course, Whitney's work at unlimitedhangout.com and thelastamericanvagabond.com. And thank you for watching. Share this information. And if you're still trusting Trump, maybe you should question that. Until next time, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free. Peace.
Since 2012, the Conscious Resistance Network has been an independent media organization focused on empowering individuals through education, philosophy, health, and community organizing. We work to create a world where corporate and state power do not rule over the lives of free human beings. Our motto is leading by example and helping others in their pursuit of freedom. Visit theconsciousresistance.com to find our articles, documentaries, interviews, podcasts, books, and more. Remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free.